the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 135, covering the week of August 20th through August 24th, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like us on Facebook at Abbeville Institute, and subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. You can find all those things by going to our website, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you got all our social media buttons. And while you're there, give us an email address, and we'll give you a free ebook. You'll also get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday. Don't forget that we also exist on your generous contributions alone. So anything you can donate to the Institute is greatly appreciated. You can donate monthly or annually. All of those options are available on our webpage as well. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says Support and Donation Levels. Just click on that. You've got all of our different levels of donation. And also, don't forget, we've got our conference, our next conference coming up November 9th and 10th. The actual event is on November 10th. If you get in on the night of the 9th, you can pay a little extra and have a Meet the Speakers event. But the topic is state nullification and secession. And we've got a great lineup of speakers, Don Livingston, Jeff Deist, Michael Bolden. Just a great time to be had by all. Kirkpatrick Sale. Dan Fisher is actually going to come speak. He's the former gubernatorial candidate for the state of Oklahoma. So a lot of good talks. Alan Mendenhall. It's going to be a great time. Get on out there, register online. You can go to our webpage. Again, at the middle of the page, you've got a section that says you're invited. Click on that. You can register online. Very painless and easy. And we'll be in Texas. So if you're in the Texas area, first time we've had a conference in Texas. So go on out and see us in Texas. All right, well, let's talk about the week. This is a really great week as far as material on the website. Such a great week for what's going on in the South. Of course, on Monday night, the Silent Sam statue at the University of North Carolina was toppled. And we had a couple of pieces about that this week. And I want to frame the podcast this week with a discussion on the pieces in relation to that and outside of that. So the piece on Friday was the oddity, but it does actually work with everything that happened. And the same thing with the piece on Tuesday, which was a book review. But let's start with the Monday piece before we get into Silent Sam, because actually the Monday piece and the Wednesday piece, I think, speak to something that we don't have in the South anymore. And I wrote the piece on Monday on Jimmy Carter, the last Republican president, and the R in that title was left lowercase on purpose, because what I was talking about there is not Republican GOP, but Republican in terms of Republicanism. This idea of what it means to be a Republican in America and in the founding tradition. And I took a lot of heat for this piece. Some people liked it, a lot of people didn't like it because they don't want to hear anything positive about Jimmy Carter. And the point of this particular piece was not to defend Jimmy Carter's policies, though I think Carter gets a bad rap on some of his policies. For example, I mentioned the piece, he appointed Volcker as Fed chairman, which did a lot of good for the United States because it stopped the runaway inflation of the 1970s. Now, some people would say, you know, interest rates being up was terrible. Yes, if you're a debtor, interest rates going up was a bad thing. However, so is runaway inflation. When your salary is not going up corresponding to inflation, it's also pinching your wallet. So this was necessary move. Also, he started the deregulation that Reagan took credit for in the 80s. Carter believed in energy independence. This is something that conservatives talk about all the time. We need to be energy independent. If you go back and look at his malaise speech, his crisis of confidence speech, this is one of the main parts of that speech. He says, look, we're not going to import a whole lot of foreign oil. We're going to dig coal. We're going to use our own oil resources, excuse me. This is what we're going to do. Well, if Donald Trump stood up and said these things, we're going to cheer. But if Jimmy Carter says it, this is because we have a hyper-politicized environment. If you say anything about somebody that's not an R, if you're a D, or if you're a Republican, or if not a D, if you're a Democrat, well, then that person's no good. And the problem with that is that you can't take people individually and look at their achievements or who they are as a person and say, oh, that's not a bad guy. Now, Jimmy Carter, the point of this entire piece is not to defend his policies, though, but to talk about Jimmy Carter as a man. And the reason I wrote it is because the Washington Post ran an article, one of the few good articles I've read in the Washington Post in a long time, talking about the uncelebrity president. But they get it wrong when they say that. They miss the mark. What Jimmy Carter was is a Republican with a lowercase r. And if you look at the founding generation and how they viewed the executive branch, Jimmy Carter did that. They didn't want the president to be an elected king. And I think of all the presidents in the last, 100 years, Jimmy Carter was the most Republican of them all. And that's because, I mean, people would say, well, what about Harry Truman? That guy was a real middle-class president. And Jimmy Carter said, Harry Truman's my guide because he was a middle-class guy, went back home. In fact, Harry Truman was the first guy to get on food stamps when the program was put in place by Lyndon Johnson. But there was a difference. Harry Truman was a politician, not a statesman. And as I said in the piece, he would kneecap people. I mean, Harry Truman actually said to his daughter in a letter, if he had all the money in the world, he would just buy votes. Now, that shows the character, Harry Truman's character, which is pretty low. Jimmy Carter would never say anything like that. Jimmy Carter walked to his inaugural. So did Thomas Jefferson. Jimmy Carter refused to have Hail to the Chief played every time he stepped on Air Force One or Marine One. He wasn't a king. He carried his own luggage. In other words, he didn't have his valet walking around with his luggage. When he left office, he went back to Plains and stayed home. He lives in the same house that he built in 1961. It's a two-bedroom ranch house. Now, how many other presidents went back to a little tiny house in their hometown, little town, and just stayed there? Well, we know Jefferson went back to his home, and he stayed there. We know John Adams went back to his home and he stayed there. We know Madison and Monroe and Washington, all five of those members of the founding generation, when their time was over, went back to their home and stayed there. And for the most part, stayed out of public life. And that's what Jimmy Carter has pretty much done. He's worked in humanitarian organizations. He's worked for charities. He teaches Sunday school. He scribbles. He paints. He builds furniture. I mean, these are the things that Jimmy Carter does. And every now and then you'll hear Jimmy Carter said this about the president, and in fact, in that Washington Post piece, he bashes Donald Trump. I don't really care about that, but he is a Republican with a lowercase r. We can quibble over policy. Jimmy Carter is on the left on a lot of issues. I don't agree with Jimmy Carter on some of the things he says, but I would take a million Jimmy Carters over the people in the left today. Because Jimmy Carter was a realist. For example, one of our members sent me a story about Jimmy Carter and the Georgia state flag. When all the dust-up was going on over the Georgia state flag, and there was talk about removing the battle flag from the Georgia state flag, and Republicans in control of the state legislature in Georgia had all these compromise flags, and none of them looked good, and the Democrat offers didn't look good, Jimmy Carter stepped forward and with his own personality, his own weight, said the people of Georgia need a Confederate flag. And so the state flag of Georgia today is a First National Confederate flag. It's what it is. And even in 2015, when he came out and said, well, we need to take the flag out of the public sphere, he also said that he didn't think the flag was racist. And when he went back to Plains, there's video of this. People are playing Dixie and there's Confederate flags. And Jimmy Carter was fine with that. You see, Jimmy Carter was Southern. Jimmy Carter is Southern. And that is what makes him somebody that people can't understand outside of the South. He's an old Southern liberal. In contrast to the mob that tore down Silent Sam, I would take an entire South of Jimmy Carter's every single day, if I had to have a choice between those leftists or the mob leftists that tore down Silent Sam. You see, this is what we're dealing with today. The leftists like Jimmy Carter in the South are disappearing because they're being instigated by outside forces. This is why we should respect someone like Jimmy Carter. We may not agree with him, but he is Southern to the core, and he recognizes what the South needs and what the South is. He is the last agrarian to be president, probably the last agrarian who will ever be president. If you've never read his An Hour Before Daylight, it is an agrarian treatise. As Ben Jones, who wrote the piece on Wednesday, he emailed me and said, you know, yeah, Jimmy Carter was a Jeffersonian. He'd go out and pick peanuts and then write a poem about it. Exactly right. How many other presidents did that besides Thomas Jefferson, you see? This is why people need to respect Jimmy Carter. And, you know, some of the stories came in. Actually, Don Livingston sent me a story about Jimmy Carter at Emory University. He picked out he had a forum there at Emory. And one of the questions was about the flag. And he gave a statement very much, you know, pro-flag, but also, you know, politically expedient. But as Don said, well, that's the best you could expect. But it wasn't anti-flag. It wasn't anti-flag at all. Jimmy Carter recognizes where he's from and who he is. He recognizes he's a Southern man. He's from the Southern people. The South created Jimmy Carter. And we're going to bash that man? I think that's short-sighted and shallow. Because if we had people like Jimmy Carter in the South, on the left, well, you wouldn't see Silent Sam come down. It wouldn't happen. No, none of that would happen. We wouldn't be talking about removing Confederate statues. Jimmy Carter was very proud of his Confederate ancestors. In An Hour Before Daylight, he's got a whole chapter dedicated to family and his Confederate ancestors. He loved them. Loved the fact that he came from Confederate ancestors. So this is the point about Jimmy Carter, and people missed it. They just see Jimmy Carter, and how dare you write an article praising Jimmy Carter? This guy's awful. This guy's terrible. Look at all these things he did. And they miss what I was discussing. The character of the man, certainly, when you go to watch, even, look, I've wrote a whole book on presidents who were awful, and it's very hard to find any that were any good. Even Thomas Jefferson had his problems in his second term was terrible in terms of violating his oath of office. It wasn't very good, and I actually said Jefferson was one of the four who tried to save America, in his first term in particular. But this is the problem with the executive branch. It's why the founding generation debated having an executive branch. But the vision of that, Jimmy Carter did it better than anyone in the 20th century. Did it better than anyone except for a handful of people in the 19th century and the 18th century. So I think to criticize the piece based on your conception of politics with Jimmy Carter is short-sighted. It's not a defense of Jimmy Carter's politics. It's a defense of Jimmy Carter as a man. And those that got that, I think there were some, but I see what you're doing here. You're talking about Jimmy Carter as a man. That's exactly right. When are we going to have a man like Jimmy Carter again? I don't see it happening. Ever. Jimmy Carter was a peanut farmer. When are we going to have a farm? He was a consummate outsider. When are we going to have that again? I mean, Donald Trump is an outsider. He doesn't have the same character as Jimmy Carter, without question. They're night and day in terms of character. So this is why people should reconsider Jimmy Carter and show the man a little respect and of who he is as a person. And I think that's, you know, one of the important parts of the of his legacy. If more people acted like Jimmy Carter in Washington, we wouldn't have an elected king. I mean, this is what we have today. And as somebody commented, well, yeah, maybe Obama needs to see that. Yeah, Obama does. Maybe so does George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush. They need to see it too. And then, you know, Trump, when Trump leaves the executive office, whenever that is, he's going to go back to being Trump, which he was always. He's a billionaire anyway, so he's going to live a different lifestyle, and he probably won't expect the taxpayers to pay much of anything. He is going to have a lot of, I think, Secret Service for the rest of his life because of his personality and how people despise the man. It's night and day when you look at Jimmy Carter compared to virtually anyone else, particularly in the 20th century, who has been president. So let's stay on that line of these Southern liberals. or at least people that you wouldn't expect necessarily to support your position. And let's talk about Silent Sam. So the two pieces we ran on Silent Sam this week, they were from different perspectives. One by Boyd Cathy, one by Ben Cooter Jones. And the one we ran on Wednesday was by Ben Jones. And he gave parts of this talk at our Charleston conference this past winter. But he made it fit with what happened in North Carolina. And I will say this personally about the toppling of the statue in North Carolina. The removal of statues in New Orleans and the attack on the statues in Virginia, those particular events, they were distressing, but nothing like what happened in North Carolina, for me personally. It's because that statue in North Carolina, Silent Sam, was dedicated to the students who went off to war and died from that university. It's a war memorial to the students of that university. And so to take it down is to spit on the face of fellow students. And why are they doing this? Well, we'll talk about that with the piece on Tuesday. But Ben Jones wrote this beautiful piece about who he was as a person. He grew up very poor, got a job working on a railroad, got to North Carolina, didn't have a lot of money, grew up on the wrong side of the tracks. He marched in the civil rights movement, so he was considered to be a Southern liberal. But he loved Silent Sam. He loved Confederate memorials and monuments and symbols. I mean, heck, he was in the Dukes of Hazzard. And he actually told a story in Charleston. He said, when I was in Congress, and I had an office in Atlanta, none of the African Americans I knew would go out there and talk about that flag on top of that car. They loved it. They loved the General Lee. It's a different time. It was 30 years ago. But they loved it. And Ben Jones is, again, like Jimmy Carter, a Southerner that if we had more Ben Jones and Jimmy Carter, we wouldn't have this situation. We can quibble on policy. We can talk about, are these things good or bad? Are these policies good or bad? But at the end of the day, these are both Southern gentlemen who love the South. And the concluding statement from Ben Jones is just beautiful. It was just a beautiful statement in what he said. And if you haven't read this piece, you need to do it. But the title of the piece is Silent Sam and Me. But his last line, the last couple of lines, let me just read these things. He said, quote, 50 plus years ago, I would look out at Silent Sam from my window in Battle Dorm and try to imagine what it have been like to go off to war in those days. I thought of Sam as maybe a youth from somewhere like Tarboro or Clinton or Hickory. He was of good heart, I figured, maybe 18 or 19, a bit thin, a bit afraid. He was of that tough North Carolina stock, that salt-of-the-earth fellow whose character is reflected in the state's motto, to be rather than to seem. He could have been my great-great-uncle Gabriel Jacobs, who was killed at Friar's Farm pursuing McClellan in his escape to the river. He was 21. He, in turn, was named for his great-great-great-grandfather, Gabriel Jacobs, a slave who was freed by his master, John Custis, in Northampton County, Virginia, in 1695. Our South is a land of many secrets and many truths. The radical trash who tore down Silent Sam and those academic idiots who enabled them are not worthy to walk on the same ground as Gabriel Jacobs. Silent Sam will rise again, and we, not they, shall overcome. It's beautiful. This is a beautiful piece. And people that think like this nowadays, unfortunately, are few and far between. That are on, you might say, they're on the a little more of the left spectrum. And I don't, Ben Jones is elected as a Democrat, and he's not a he's a conservative Democrat, what they would call a blue dog Democrat today, But regardless, this is what we need more of. And as he says, the radical trash. And why are these people being instigated? Well, the piece on Thursday speaks to that, by Boyd Cathy, A Battle for Western Civilization and the South. He gets into who these people actually are. They're being funded and supported. These aren't all students, but groups like the Democratic Socialists of America or the Communist Workers World Party. These are the groups that are looking to take down these statues. And the problem is, you don't have enough quote-unquote conservatives standing up to them. He mentions John Hood, who's from the John Locke Foundation in North Carolina, who essentially capitulates. Because even though Hood says, quote, his love of state history is broad and deep, it does not extend to the Confederacy itself. And so this is the situation we're facing. You have conservatives who are not even as staunch as Ben Jones and saying these things need to see. Why not love the conservative, the Confederate history of our state? These are just common people, went out and fought. That's what they were. They didn't have any, I mean, look, as Ben Jones says, you know, I had a great-great-great-great-grandfather who was a slave in Virginia in 1695. And I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks. I mean, my people weren't rich slave owners, and yet they went and fought for North Carolina. And you're going to say that that's just hate? It's because these people have been told over and over again that that's all this is. That's what this is all about. Even on the so-called right, you have this issue. And so this is what it comes down to. You have outside forces working. And a lot of these people that tore down the statue, they weren't even students at UNC. They were outside. They were instigators. And, of course, the police being told to stand down. The situation there was just a mess. There should be some type of repercussions for the president of the university. And, of course, all the people that did this should be rounded up and thrown in jail. But this is what we've come to. And when outside forces are involved in this, Democratic Socialists of America, United Communist World Workers Party, these are your allies, John Hood. These are the people you want to align with. You don't want to align with the Boyd Cathys or the Ben Jones. You want to align with those people? Because that's essentially what you're doing by saying that these things need to come down, or these things need to be contextualized, or we need to do something else, create some other type of environment for these statues. But that's what you're doing. Well, why don't we contextualize everything in America then? Why not start contextualizing the Lincoln Memorial? Why not the Washington Memorial Monument? Why not the Jefferson Memorial? Should we contextualize all these things? Should we contextualize the national anthem because of who wrote it? I mean, should we do that? Should we contextualize the Constitution? How about the Declaration? Should we contextualize those things? Put a disclaimer by everything we do? Is that what we're going to do today? Contextualize, disclaimer, tear stuff down. I mean, there are people out there that will want to do that without question. They're admitting it in some cases. Those that are bold enough saying, yeah, we'd love to have George Washington come down. We'd love to have Andrew Jackson come down, Thomas Jefferson. We'd love to take all that down. We'd love to rename everything that essentially predated 1970. Because that's what you have to do in this particular situation. You've got to erase American history before 1970. And then if you can't erase it, you start telling a different story. And you make everyone feel bad about it. And therefore, they're going to want to do it. And that's part of the what we talked about on Tuesday. What are we exporting also? What is America exporting, not just here, but into outer space? That's another question we have in one of our pieces. So let's talk about this. Where are these vicious attacks come from? And of course, it comes from the university environment. It comes from the academy. It comes from what people are told. about the South. You've got Southern Studies programs. I just did on my own podcast. If you don't subscribe to that, it's the Brian McClanahan Show. You can go to my webpage, brianmcclanahan.com, and get that. But if you, there was a Time magazine issue dedicated to the South, and it was all about how the South is wrong and backwards and needs to be fixed. And you've got Southern Studies programs that say the same thing. Every single course on the South is about the South being the odd other in America, the odd section. The Southerners are just bad people. They're just devils walking around. It's like New England has written everything, and of course it has. Even Southerners buy this now. They're so guilty of themselves that they'll buy into these kind of things. Well, the piece on Tuesday was about a little book, a local history, actually, and it's not not widely published, but one of Clyde Wilson's other students, John Devaney, was in the eastern shore of Virginia, and he found this little book. It's entitled Slave and Free on Virginia's Eastern Shore, written by Kirk Mariner, who we later found out is no longer alive. He's deceased. And this was his life work. And he went out, he wrote another number of other little books on the Eastern Shore of Virginia. And I actually grew up in that particular area, the Delmarva Peninsula. Wonderful place. And of course, Abel Upshur's from there. There were others, Tazewell. There were other people from the Eastern Shore of Virginia that were important members of the South and Southern history. And what he found in this book was that the situation in Virginia is not necessarily what you would conceptualize. I mean, look, we get our images of labor in the South and that type of thing from pop culture. And if you go out and read Fogel and Engerman's Time on the Cross or Genovese's Roll, Jordan, Roll, if you read these books, you're going to have a much different perspective on Southern slavery. And basically, and this book gets into that. Look, things were not always, it's not black and white. There was a lot of gray in the labor system of Virginia. It wasn't always bad. Of course, it's not good. You're talking about slavery in terms of a labor relationship. But what Mariner found was that the labor relationship in Virginia was often determined by the individuals who owned the plantations. It was determined by custom and precedent. In fact, what he found in this particular book is that slaves had legal recourse in many cases. Also, Marshall DeRosa's determined this in much of his groundbreaking work on Southern legal cases, on legal decisions in the South. And so Mariner verifies that by going through and painstakingly looking at local histories, primary documents from the Eastern Shore of Virginia. And again, what he finds is that this image we get of slavery that we get from things like Roots or from the abolitionist literature from the 1850s, Uncle Tom's Cabin, is sensationalized in many ways. Again, it's not to defend the institution, but it's to say that it's to understand the institution, it's to make it more complex, which is really what we're going after if we're talking about history. The object of history is to understand. And the object of history is not to create a sensationalized environment, but to understand the people and the place and the time. And so he gives you many different examples. I actually have the book, and he gives you many different examples from the Eastern Shore, that talk about Virginia being a society with slaves, not a slaveholding society, particularly early on. And there's a difference in that. These were not rigid ideologues, pro-slavery ideologues. They were individuals who had plantations, who had slavery as a labor system. Now, some of that did change, but as John Devaney points out in the piece, he says, look, wait a second here. You know, I've always thought that there was a lot of these slave codes were unenforceable because it depended on the plantation itself as to what the condition of these slaves would be like. And that's what Genovese found in Roll, Jordan, Roll. That's what Fogel and Engerman found in Time on the Cross. So this book, as a local history, and there should be a lot more work done on this because it's very hard to write comprehensive histories, as people started trying to do back in the early 20th century, mid to early 20th century, particularly the early 20th century. When you had Earl U.B. Phillips out writing the first histories of slavery in the South, there were a lot of, it was very difficult to do because you had to try to find these local plantation journals and other things. And so this was a difficult process. And I think if you're a historian of this particular period and of this particular segment of Southern society, there's a lot of work still to be done. And then, so what are we exporting? We're to many people, what we're exporting out of the South is this image we get in pop culture of the South, and it's distorted. And then we're also exporting, as Americans, Abraham Lincoln. And the last piece of the week on Friday was this kind of, I loved it because it put together the futuristic with the historical. Abraham Lincoln is on Mars. Whether you knew that or not, he is. There's a Lincoln penny on the Mars rover, and it's there for calibration, but it was chosen on purpose to put a Lincoln penny there. So we've exported Abraham Lincoln to Mars. So if there is life out there beyond Earth, the first thing they're going to come across with us on a distant planet is Abraham Lincoln. Now think about that. We've got the Lincoln Memorial now, not just in America, but also in the United States, but also on Mars. So this is what we're exporting. This is the image people get of the South. It all works together. You see all the stuff that happened in Silent Sam, all the things that happened in attacking the South, all that is working together. It's the Lincolnian America. It's the sensationalized literature of the 1850s and then later on. That's what the issue is. That's why people want to topple a statue. And it's all wrong. It's all wrong. There's no complexity in it. There's no understanding in it. It's just vicious, ideologically driven nonsense. But this is what we're dealing with today in America. And if we're willing to put a Lincoln penny as a calibration instrument on a rover that we send to Mars, we've got to undo this entire Lincolnian image of America. And I think that's one thing Don Livingston has been trying to do now for the last 20 plus years, is to undo that. And this is what the Abbeville Institute exists for. So I hope you enjoyed the material you have for this week. Until next time, good day.